Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Jared Alexander immersed himself in war games, war movies, and everything war. He grew up playing with guns and was obsessed with the military, like his father, mother, stepfather, and grandfather before him. He enlisted straight out of high school into the U.S. Marines. Once in Iraq, he came to realize he was fighting a lost cause. Enmeshed in the ongoing war on terror, that was really just a fruitless display of American might. The myths of war were a mirage. Volunteers, Growing Up in the Forever War is his book. Joining me on the Zoom platform, I welcome Jared Alexander, the author. Jared, your memoir was powerful. It was a powerful voice in reckoning with the truths of the American war machine. He served as a U.S. Marine infantryman and combat correspondent from 1998 to 2006 with deployments in the Mediterranean, East Africa, and Iraq. Jared, welcome to 411 Teen. I've been looking forward to talking with you.
Well, thanks, Dr. Hollyfield. I appreciate that. And thanks for the kind words at the front there.
Oh, well, I'm telling you, I read your book. It was just really enlightening for me. So I want to give you all the praise possible and recommend that everybody read it. Why did you write Volunteers? What was the impetus for you to write that book?
Well, I started out with the intention of writing a very traditional war story, something in line with Tim O'Brien's If I Die in a Combat Zone or Tobias Wolff's In Pharaoh's Army or A Rumor of War by Philip Puto. Those books were books that I read as a teenager and were really fascinated by. And I wanted to contribute to that canon. Well, as I started to write it, though, I began to realize that I had to talk more about my childhood in order to frame what I was experiencing in the Marine Corps. And then as that went along and as that sort of matured, I began to realize that that was really the story itself. Mm-hmm. The things that I was surrounded by as a kid formed me as a Marine. It formed me into somebody who would inevitably enlist into the military and end up wanting to go fight in a war, irrespective of the necessity of that conflict or the correctness of that war. So it had an evolutionary process. It started out as one thing and sort of became another. And I tried to merge the two eventually. I tried to reconcile the two. I felt like I couldn't write about childhood and war without a war somewhere in the story. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't write about war without my childhood somewhere in the story.
Well, they were dependent on each other just about, it seemed like, in reading it, okay? You had to have, you know, your childhood to explain where you got to, how you got where you were. Did you have a target population you were thinking about when you were writing this book?
You know, I think who I really wanted to talk to was the person who had no experience with it, who does not have a connection to the military. And that's a large audience. The volume of people who are fighting wars for the United States or have fought wars has diminished drastically from World War II. I think it's a very, very small percent of the population. I think 7% is where we're at. Mm-hmm. Whereas compared to World War II, it was, you know, you could throw a handful of rocks across the street and hit six people who were in the war.
Right.
And that's not the case anymore. And there are good reasons for that and also some bad. And so when I sat down to write it, I wanted to write it for the person who didn't have a connection to it. That was the audience that I was seeking.
Well, you did a good job because I did not know anything about growing up in a military family. I mean, it was an eye-opener for me. It was very enlightening. And, you know, I kept reading and reading and reading. I mean, I couldn't put your book down. So I thought it was great, okay? Share with the listening audience the significance of the name Volunteers?
Well, the title comes from the idea that everyone in the U.S. military is a volunteer. The draft ended in 72. So everyone from then on, anybody in the military chooses to be there. Now, the motivations for those things are fairly broad. And I talk a little bit about that in the book, you know, why people sort of end up in the military, or why I ended up, why other folks did. But ultimately, it's a very, very binary choice. You either choose to not join the military or you choose to join it. Mm-hmm. And so it changes the dynamic. It changes the moral landscape in a way. Instead of a draftee whose sensibilities are, I am forced to do this thing that I find potentially reprehensible. And this is especially true for people in Vietnam who were drafted. And that, like, the literature is full of that. Tim O'Brien talks about that. And I'm being asked to do something that I'm being told about to do something that I don't want to impart it. Well, that's no longer applicable. And so one of the things that I was really interested in is trying to unpack why someone would want to go off to fight a war. And I think it's broader than just basic ideas of patriotism. That's an aspect of it, certainly. I think that that's a component, you know, being a good citizen. Now, mind you, I think that citizenship can show itself in other places. You don't have to go in the military to be a good citizen. Let me be very clear there. In fact, I think that we need to change the polarity there. I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, it felt like, excuse me, go on. I was going to just say, it felt like you were indoctrinated to the ways and expectations of the military. I mean, growing up, you know, in a military family and growing up on a barracks and base, life was very insular. And was that do I have an accurate depiction?
To a degree, yes. I almost refer to it more as an enculturation. I was so surrounded by it. Now, I had options. I could have potentially gone in other directions, and sometimes I think I should have. There are moments when I do believe that. But at the same time, it was so present in my life, you know, either both from the films and television. I was a kid of the 80s. I was, eight, nine, 10 years old, right there in the late 80s. And so the films and television programs we were producing were very Cold War driven, and then Vietnam obviously had a big part of that. Platoon comes out, Hamburger Hill and Full Metal Jacket. And those were huge influences on me as a child and as a teenager in the 90s. So I just couldn't really, while I had other interests, it always ended up being forced to take a back seat to this thing that I was constantly around. And it wasn't a positive and or negative experience. It was just an experience. There were good aspects to it and bad. I don't like running into a rote definition of the military. I think that you can end up creating a stereotype where one need not exist. But it was really just kind of everywhere. It was in the air with the aircraft. My stepfather fights he serves in the Persian Gulf War. I knew family members who were in other conflicts. You know, my mother was in the Air Force. My stepfather and father were in the Air Force. And I had grandparents that were Army and Air Force as well. And so it was just a constant. It was a constant. It wasn't a pressure. There was no pressure to it. But it was just a constant. It was like being in a funnel, but it was a naturally occurring one.
It was all around you. I mean, I kind of got the feeling, and again, correct me if I'm reading it wrong, that the attitudes and the ideologies were hardwired into children who grew up under those circumstances. That's the feeling I got out of reading. I mean, you did have a choice, but given what was around you, I mean, what did you expect? I don't know.
It was very much, I was very much a product of my environment. We use that term, or we use that phrase in a lot of different contexts, and it applies here. I was very much just a product of my environment. The mythology of it was mm-hmm. very attractive. And I think that, especially considering a lot of the mythology is very simple. You know, the way we tell stories about the military in a fast way is very simple. It's about heroes up against villains. It's very David and Goliath in certain contexts, mm-hmm. You know, and America, American exceptionalism is baked all in that. You know, there's a lot of that thread right through that. And that was certainly present in my childhood. You know, the shining city on a hill sort of conversation that's taking place, that took place a lot, for better or worse. And so it was just even the stories of Vietnam had that. Even though I recognized even as a teenager that it was flawed and clumsy and in certain places immoral, those stories out of Vietnam were just as powerful to me,
mm-hmm.
because they were very binary. It was heroes against villains, even if they were fighting in a conflict that was inherently flawed. You know, a lot of the stories, and I talk a little bit about this as it relates to Marine boot camp, were sort of filled with a lot of stories and a lot of myths about, and they're very true stories, quite frankly. Well, they're all true stories of Marines who are saving their buddies on battlefields or valiantly attacking bunkers on Japanese held islands or Vietnamese mountainsides, you know. And those stories are kind of what drive people and to a certain extent into the military. There's a lot of expectation there, and there's a lot of it's valor, and it's an attractive trait, and it's an attractive thing to want to live up to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. What was, and you may not have time to finish this, we'll take a quick break, but I wanted you to talk about the Civil Air Patrol, mm-hmm. and just what that involved.
Well, the Civil Air Patrol is an auxiliary of the U.S. Air Force, and it primarily, it has a number of real-world missions, but one of its components is basically serving as sort of a Boys and Girl Scouts for young people.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. it's a co-ed environment, and you can, you know, young people at the age of 12 and older can join up, and it's not really much of a commitment. You know, I think you just got to pay some dues and, you know, go to meetings. Okay. You learn how to wear a uniform, and it's very similar to like a junior reserve officer training corps program that you find in high schools. Works very similar to that. It just has some extra components that tend to work outside of a school.
Okay. All right. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I am talking with Jared Alexander, author of Volunteers Growing Up in the Forever War. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return shortly and continue our conversation on his recent book. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and let me reintroduce today's guest, Jared Alexander, author of Volunteers Growing Up in the Forever War. Jared, how would you describe your growing up? How did, in a military family, how did it affect you?
Well, you know, I think my family operated pretty much as any other family. Mm-hmm. The day-to-day life of the military at its core is kind of a 9-to-5 job. It just has aspects of it where, you know, you end up deployed overseas, and the job can be a little, it is somewhat more insular than other fields. But on average, the military bases, especially the one that I grew up at, you had a homegrown community right there. And it was very much, I refer to it as the castle. And that was because you had people that were on the base or who were sort of part of the organization. And then you had the people who were not. And there was a loose, and it was not, there was a hint of judgment in it, but there was a very loose, it was a loose caste system in a certain sense. And it was sort of silly in retrospect, but that did exist. There was this kind of work on the inside versus the outside. And that sort of sets up some things that I saw amplified as a Marine. Whereas in the Marine Corps, they sort of teach that, you know, the Marine is above the average person,
mm-hmm.
in the Marine culture. And which is a,
A Marine is the king. That's what, you know.
Right.
I mean, you know, just from where I was, where I stand and knowing nothing but Marines were the ultimate. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they teach that. Mm-hmm. And they teach that very hard. And they're very, very, very firm on that point. There's some ramifications to that in our culture once the Marine leaves the service. And the aspects of our politics that where that has come to play. And it's small, but a significant problem. As a kid, you had commonality with everyone around you in a neighborhood or with most people in a elementary school class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember during the Persian Gulf War particularly, like there was an instant galvanizing force sort of bringing us all even closer together than we already were when all of our fathers and some of our mothers were picked up and sent to the Middle East. Like there was this tightening, you know, mm-hmm. that happened, like the wives and mothers in the community and on the base itself. You saw a lot of checking in, you know, like daycares were being set up in people's houses and that sort of thing. There was a sort of it was very familial and it was instantaneous. The support system was built in and it still is. The military still is very much that way. In fact, it's probably more so now than it was then because at the time it wasn't readily expected that our fathers and some of our mothers were going to deploy overseas. Now during my time in the Marine Corps and then after, it was a routine occurrence. And so those structures are a lot more firm, but even then it was just a sense of community that I think was hard to find or maybe hard to replicate outside of the military.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of what they called the military family syndrome. Are you familiar with that?
I don't think so.
I think it refers to just kind of the behavioral and psychosocial problems of children of deployed parents, as well as even the effects of the deployment on the relationship between the child and the parent that's remaining at home. In preparation for your program, I encountered that military family syndrome, so I just wondered if you were familiar with it. The general attitude amongst the military was that they served as a defense, I guess, against others who believed that their way was the right way and enforced it through power, well, I guess I want to say violence, really, over others. And so the military, now that's just kind of what I got out of it. The military was there to serve as a defense against this. Is that the way these wars evolved, that they were defending others?
That was certainly the, okay. Yes, that was certainly
okay.
The narrative, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. All right. Was there a moral code of ethics, though? That's something I didn't get a feel for at all.
Well, they're more in terms of having an individual moral compass in the military. That is very much on the individual. However,
mm-hmm. Okay,
you know, but however, there are codes of conduct in the military that drive they're meant to drive a person's behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Marine Corps has a set of core values: honor, they honor, courage, and commitment. I believe what they are, and what those are designed to do is sort of instill in young Marines a sense of responsibility to them, to their own character, and to the character of the service that they're involved with. And all branches of the military have something similar to this. And what those are designed to do is sort of shape the moral compass and point the moral compass in the right direction. Now, when it comes to the narrative you described a minute ago about us being in defense of a force that is trying to exert its will on others,
mm-hmm.
that is true in general terms, or at least I think that it has been in certain contexts. But the definitions of that have been sort of warped in a lot of ways. I think of Vietnam again. As a justification for that, like the attitude was, we are defending a country who's trying to exert a communist will on that country, and so that became the sort of narrative by which we sent troops over to fight and defend those people. when in reality it was a little bit more complex. Mm-hmm. You know, and that also applies to the Iraq War and to elements of the Afghanistan. You know, there is components of those conflicts that are morally murky.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the motivations of those conflicts are morally murky, especially true for the Iraq War, which we were the aggressor in. We were fighting a proactive conflict there and invaded a country in the process of that. And that's a moral quandary when you're asking people to defend a way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whose life are we defending in this point? Because we certainly weren't defending American ways, the way of life. We were trying to exert our will on somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
The tables have turned, you know. We're seeing that play out very similarly with Russia and Ukraine. Yeah.
Well, it seems like the reasons are flawed. You know, the reasons that this war is based on, whatever it is they're flawed. They're flawed national reasons. I mean, like Vietnam exposed, you know, inconsistencies, lots of inconsistency of the fabric of our supposedly culture.
Right. And so when you have a conflict that has a weak moral foundation, mm-hmm. when it translates downstream to the individual soldier, you end up with a moral dilemma. You know, every mm-hmm. action you take has a higher moral weight to it. You know, if I am fighting an insurgent with my rifle, or I am engaged in battle with one force versus another, well, those the situation that has been created there has flaws in it, and the individual who is fighting it starts to have some doubts and starts to have concerns, and they also start the causes that are motivating them to behave in certain ways become smaller. They become more concerned about just getting home and mm-hmm. making sure that their friends get home. Well, that's kind of a bad pattern to get into when you're fighting wars. If your entire objective is just to get there and then get out, well, that's kind of
yeah.
that's a murky. You're not accomplishing anything. You're just sort of creating a hamster wheel that you just get on and off every single time.
Yeah.
And that's not healthy. And that was kind of how Afghanistan was fought, especially from the way our strategy to that conflict was fought that way. So, and then you end up with moral, every war runs the risk, every individual fighting a war, no matter the cause of the conflict, runs the risk of causing themselves moral injury. But when you have an overarching cause of a conflict that's on a murky moral ground, mm-hmm. the likelihood of a moral injury on the individual mm-hmm. soldier is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Vietnam, we saw that especially in Vietnam and in the Iraq War, as we, you know, psychiatric casualties are typically mm-hmm. higher in those conflicts because they don't have a galvanizing sense of why they're there, and they don't they're unable to balance the moral aspects of this conflict with the behavior in the field.
Mm-hmm. You described your experience at one point in the book as what was it? Aggressive tourism, I think.
Oh, it was a war tourism.
Yeah. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, that's so.
I read your book.
That's good. I love it. No, that's great. I love that. I actually love it when people bring that up because it's an interesting thing to me. And I always forget about it because I, you know, the process being that one is to publish a book is always very slow and long, and mm-hmm. other life kind of happens. But so, what I thought was interesting was one thing I noticed, and I'll talk about that through an example that I present. So I'm sitting on a rooftop, and a captain comes onto the roof to call in an airstrike on a building somewhere out in front of us, about 1,000, maybe 2,000 meters, and probably further away. And you know, he calls down the bomb, and he's announcing the time to impact. Effectively, the pilots announced to him, "Hey, we're going to be dropping a bomb," and he does what he does in the plane, and then the bomb's falling. And you know, he's calling out the seconds effectively. Well, all the Marines around me, at least a good many of them, start pulling out cameras. They start pulling out all these little digital cameras they've bought, and they're aiming it. And they ask the captain, "Well, where's this thing falling?" And he kind of points them, and they all sort of aim there with these cameras in their hand, and they start taking pictures when the bomb hits. And it was so startling to me. I was like, and then later on, we come up on that house, and there were some people trapped in that house who hadn't been killed in the process of that bomb falling. And that was a bit of an experience for me.
I'm sure.
But I remember, it was so absurd. But it was so like, it was such an American thing. It was very much a, you know, I'm thinking, speaking extemporaneously, you know, I am speaking for an average Marine. I grew up in a place that doesn't have any of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's, we can argue as mundane, you know, that is very sedate. It's very safe in a lot of contexts. And now I'm in this place that I've seen on the news. I'm in this place that is in the front pages of the biggest newspaper in this country, or is on the screen of some of the biggest news outlets in our ecosystem. And I call it the leading edge of history, you know, like, and you're a 19, 20, 21, 22, 23 year old who's at the very edge of it, the very front line of it, the very front leading edge. You want to grab that and take it home a little bit. You want to kind of remember that. You want to grab a piece of that, put it in your pocket. And I saw a lot of that through photos. I think an interesting project that somebody, I am not the guy to do it, but maybe I should explore it more, but somebody should collect, do a national or international database of photo, of private photographs taken during the war and gather all of it. And I would be stunned if a large majority of those photographs weren't people just having others take pictures of them in the places where they are, either under fire or in combat zones, or just somewhere in the far edge of the fighting or far edge of the conflict, because it's so powerful to be out there and be a part of that. It's like I say, I think I may have cut this line. I can't remember, but I had written at one point, college kids take backpacking trips to Europe. Marines go to war.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it's because there's an analogy. I'm making a comparison between those two things. And there's a commonality between those two things. And I think that there is a kind of, especially for Americans, a kind of fascination with war, sort of appeal to it. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about in the book as well, is I wanted to sort of try my own sort of very clumsy literary way to sort of peel back the layers on that a little bit and expose that for what it is. Like, there is something very atavistic about human nature that wants to be a part of this.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Tim O'Brien says as much. I mean, and others who have written about wars have said it as well, that there is something kind of interesting and fascinating about watching, you know, machine gun tracers arc across a battlefield. Watch artillery fire. It's a spectacle. It's the reason why we have fireworks on the 4th of July.
Yeah, exactly.
It's exactly the same reason.
Do you think one ever reaches closure after serving in military wars?
I'm wary of speaking for a mass there, but I think that for myself, I know that I have. I have come to a place where I think that I am okay talking about other things. Now that doesn't mean that I won't write about war. I'm still fascinated with the subject in general terms, but if I spend the rest of my career as a writer writing about other things and I'm happy doing that, I'm going to be okay about leaving the war on the table. And I've just kind of come into that recently within the past few months, actually. I had a lot of ideas about what I was going to write next about the war. And I've written a novel that I'm hoping to publish that talks a little bit about the ramifications of our culture as it relates to war. But I don't know that I have a lot. My drive for being involved in the discussion of American conflicts, especially on the leading edge of it, has waned dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So that means for me that I have come to a place where I am at general peace with it.
Okay.
You know, I've been out of the military longer than I was ever in it. And I've sort of come to I wouldn't dare say happy place with it, but definitely more content.
Well, the military seems to extinguish the I, the independent thinking. It seems like that is discouraged. How did you get where you are? because you wouldn't be where you are if you did not maintain your independent thinking.
I would say that I found a lot of Marines who were up against forces like that and who mm-hmm. are really good at my best friend who I talk about in the book, Ken. We talk a lot about this. He's like, you know, one of the reasons why he got out of the Marine Corps and one of the reasons why I left it was the rigidity of thinking sometimes became mm-hmm. too much to bear. And it wasn't in, now mind you, it wasn't in a very serious capacity. It was in petty bureaucratic stuff. It was in your MASH level stuff. You know, it mm-hmm. was like the mm-hmm. silliness of it.
I think you said something about a haircut.
Yeah. It was like, because I didn't get my haircut on the right day of the week. You know, it was like I had to, you know, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, I think a lot of people in the military, especially I think in the author side of the military narrative, there's a kind of quiet eye roll, or maybe we just don't talk about that kind of thing because it seems petty, but
it didn't seem petty to somebody outside, you know, just what's the big deal?
Right.
That's the way I reacted to it when I read it. I was like, what?
Right. But there's a lot of that. And if you talk to enlisted men, especially enlisted men and women, they will probably bring that up. You know, they will, depends on when they got out and what their rank was and how high up there, because the higher you go, the easier it gets in a lot of regard. But, you know, sergeants and lance corporals and privates and corporals and, you know, early staff sergeants, they, you know, these are things that they have to put up with. And they do, and these sort of little idiosyncratic, you know, aspects of the military, mm-hmm. really, these little idiosyncrasies really, for me, like, define the experience in a lot of ways. Because mm-hmm. combat for the average person in the military is an incredibly rare experience.
Hold your thoughts. Jared, this is that time when I said I was going to to interrupt you. Hold your thoughts. We're going to take a brief break. You're tuned into 411 Teen. I'm talking with Jared Alexander. We'll return on the flip side of the break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
You tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I was talking with Jared Alexander. Jared, I had to interrupt you. Did you want to continue your thought?
Oh, sure, yeah. So what I was saying was that the average combat experience is a remarkably rare thing for a service member to experience, mm-hmm. like the extreme ends of the danger. The average experience is the day-to-day stuff. Mm-hmm. It is those little mm-hmm. those little shuffling of paperwork and those dealing with one thing or another. And my friends and I who are in the Marine Corps, most of what we talk about is that. We find that the people in combat were typically very professional. They were the jobs that when it came time to do that kind of work, they were usually very good at it. And it was and even to this day, it's very kind of awe-inspiring that they were as good as they are. It says a lot about our sort of need for it, because we've been in so many wars that we kind of have to have people who are that good at the job, but they are good at it. And mm-hmm. that aspect of it is deserving of merit or deserving of attention and merits. And but there's also that other side of the military, which I think is kind of lost a little bit. And that is the sort of the drudgery of it, the day-to-day, the cloggery, you know, just the clogging of your arteries, so to speak, you know, mm-hmm. like you're just kind of, and it's frustrating. It isn't like the story you mentioned with the haircut, like little things like that were just so like, I almost refer to them as soul sucking, you know, mm-hmm. But they're also incredibly comical. Like they can be converted into absurdity or satire really fast. Mm-hmm. And those things I think are really interesting. If I were to ever write a novel about the Marine Corps, I think that it would be primarily that stuff.
Becoming a Marine meant becoming a man. Did you really, had you just really internalized that?
Well, I think that the Marine Corps sort of put that into the, it was part of the narrative of boot camp. That's what they were effectively saying. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lot of the language they used was that. They used it, it was a bit more crude, to be frank. But there was a lot of that sort of you're turning from, there's a couple of conversions going on. You're turning into a quote nasty civilian into a Marine, which is one, mm-hmm. which sort of taps at the caste system I was sort of referring to. But then there was this, and then there was this sort of, you're turning into a bunch of boys out of high school into men who were, mm-hmm. you know, basically trained killers is what they referred to mm-hmm. as, and basically trained Marines.
When it was time for you to get out, though, you re-upped because you hadn't been to war, right?
That's right.
The war was so, why was war, again, so special?
You know, it's a little like a lot of Marines or a lot of people in the military will equate it to sort of being benched on a football team. Mm. You know, you spend all that time training and you spend all that time sort of dipped in that language and in those ethos and myths that it feels like a waste to not want to participate in something like that. Mm-hmm. It feels like you just spent 4 to 5, 6, 7 years not doing the thing that you set out to do. And then, mm-hmm. so now, like right now, the military is in a situation where it was when I first enlisted, and that is, there's not a routine deployment into a war zone. There's a peacetime military in general terms. Now that's not absolute, but for the large majority of them, they're kind of back in the States, just waiting for the next war to start. And you know, knock on wood, hope one doesn't. But that was my experience during my first 3 years in the Marine Corps, was a lot of brush fire possibilities. Mm-hmm. You know, the stuff in the Adriatic and some of the stuff in the Middle East, but not a lot of big picture war, a lot of big army stuff. Mm-hmm. 9/11 happens my third year in the military. And I knew right away, you know, obviously Afghanistan was going to be targeted. That was an obvious, but it was going to grow. You know, it was obvious even then in 2001 and 2002. I mean, we were discussing Iraq, I think as late as December of 2001, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Could be wrong on that, but it was like right in that same few months. And I felt, I'm not going to say that I felt obligated to stay, because that, other than the obligation I had to my own interest in it, the aspects of service were a inherent part of the job. So I didn't think of them as a direct, it wasn't like I was making the decision based on that directly. It was just a naturally occurring part of the job. The service to the country was baked into the experience, right? Mm-hmm. So my interest in staying was purely an obligation to the desires I'd had when I enlisted. And that was to, on a long enough timeline, find myself in a place where I could go and be on a front line and experience that. Mm-hmm. And so in order to do that, I had to stay in the military. Now, I talk about Ken, who does something very different. He leaves the military and goes off and does the same thing as a contractor. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is a very different dynamic there. There's different, there's a lot of different other factors at play in that decision. That I sort of talk about to a degree. And, but I decided to stick around and, try my luck with the Marine Corps and see if they would send me overseas. And it took some doing, but eventually they did.
Yeah. But well, you started to question your whole decision to join the Marines. I mean, what happened? Did you feel like you made a mistake? Because I got feelings you were questioning what it was all about. You might have been conflicted, not so much about the fear of dying, but the whole thing of, was life meaningless? You were going through some changes at that point.
I think that what I was doing was I was becoming fatigued, and I was starting to become self-aware mm-hmm. of the toxicity of this chase that I was on. Because I didn't go to Iraq until my last deployment. I did 3 deployments overseas, and the third one was my deployment to Iraq. What I began to realize toward the end there, I was like, man, I'm really chasing this thing that is a little bit odd to be chasing. You know, you know, it's a heck of a goal, you know, like as far as goals are concerned, mm-hmm. That was what I wanted, and that's not an unusual thing. Well, it's an unusual thing, but it is not unheard of thing. Like that is a thing that it does happen in the military and does happen outside of it. I became wary of a lot of the ways the military sort of behaved and operated on a day-to-day level, like I was talking about earlier. I was getting really exhausted with that. I felt like I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder to a degree. And I felt a little bit like, sometimes I felt like, Lord, I feel like I'm smarter than some of the people that I'm required to answer to. Mm-hmm. I didn't like, which is a terrible thing to say. I don't mean to suggest that in the sense that those people weren't smart necessarily, but mm-hmm. I felt like the decisions they were making didn't make a lot of sense. And early on in my time in the military, there was a bit of that, but that was because I just didn't understand enough of it. Later mm-hmm. in my time in the military, it was like I understood enough of it and still knew that it was wrong, mm-hmm. or still knew that it didn't make a lot of sense, or that, or just the behaviors of some of the folks were there was backbiting, there's pettiness and that sort of thing. And I really became very tired of it. And I don't miss any of it. We laugh at it now, my friends and I, but I don't miss a morsel of that. There are aspects of the Marine Corps I do miss.
What are they? What do you miss?
You know, I on a rugged training range, you'd come off the back of it and you would have the greatest sense of accomplishment. Mm. You would come off of it you would be exhausted. And there would be a certain camaraderie around the people you were with, even in combat that existed. And I was in a lot of combat with, just by virtue of the job, I was always in combat with not strangers, but not people I was very close to. There were people I would attach to a unit and spend a few days or a week or two with a rifle squad or a truck crew, and I would hang out with them and write about what they did. So my connection was always very, very, I was sort of an appendage in a way, and a lot of that. But I tried to, you know, become part of that team and typically did. And even those groups, that was such a galvanized, those bonds are really, really, they matter to me a lot to this day. You know, I don't think I've ever laughed as hard as I have in my life. And funny enough, I just did a road trip with Ken not but a few months ago. And we took a little trip out west, and just talking about some of the stuff from then, and then just our just experience on the road, it brought back a lot of that stuff. And we just, I mean, I crashed the car laughing, you know, so those things I miss. I do miss some of that. Some of the work I do miss, you know, especially as an infantryman. Weirdly enough, I have a lot of love and respect for that field. I enjoyed what I did in it. It was a huge conflict to leave it. It was a struggle. I had to really, when I made the decision, I felt it was the right call, and so much to a degree still do, but I always have that little bit of a little bit of self-incrimination for leaving it.
Well, at one point in the book, I think you wrote that, especially among the infantrymen, that they hated the military, and that they counted every single day. I guess that's when you were going through your low period, huh? Because I know I read that.
The guys in Vietnam would do that especially. Mm-hmm. The guys in my first unit, there was a lot of, I cannot wait to get done with this.
Yes.
There was a lot of that. And it was for the reasons I described. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was sort of an us versus the system, you know, kind of attitude that prevailed. But I found that wasn't absolute all the time. I would come into units that were a little bit lighter about that and weren't so maybe demoralized as a fashion statement, where they were a little bit more galvanized around the idea and they were a little less in a rush. That said, the infantry is kind of a strange field, because it, in the Marine Corps and in the Army, well, this is especially true for the Marine Corps. I won't speak too clearly in the Army, but the Marine Corps, it's the number one field. It is everything that revolves around infantry in a lot of ways. Though it's a little muddy and they tend not to acknowledge it, but the infantryman is the number one guy. Mm-hmm. Like if you're an infantryman in the Marine Corps, you are at the center of the Marine Corps. You're from a spiritual level, from a operational level. Like you're the guy everything sort of works to support, help, and ensure is like doing its job and making sure things are well. There isn't a commandant. I think there's only been a handful of commandants who have not been infantrymen.
Okay.
So almost universally, the guy who's in charge of the Marine Corps isn't former infantryman or has been or is been. So there's this kind of dynamic in where they have a lot of pride and they know kind of who they are in the cast, if you will. But at the same time, they get really tired of doing the work. it's exhausting and it's mind numbing sometimes. And it's taxing and it's physically painful sometimes. But it's also very rewarding. So you have this sort of weird back and forth that goes on between the two. And it's kind of fun to watch.
I am talking with Jared Alexander, author of Volunteers, Growing Up in the Forever War. Jared, how does anyone get your book? Where is it available? We will be talking. I looked at the clock and I was like, wait a minute. I need to let folks know about the book. We're just going on and on and on. Share with my listening audience where they can secure your book.
Well, you
and
can
contact
just,
you too also.
You can get the book just about anywhere, but I would say the best place to get it is from an independent bookseller. You can go to bookshop.org and order it there, and it'll support an independent bookseller instead of your Amazons and Barnes & Noble. But you can also get it there if that's easier. As far as contacting me, I'm on Twitter at Jared_Alexander. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me. Mm-hmm. I also have a website, jaredalexander.com, though I don't believe you can get a hold of me on that right now.
Okay. All right. In these last few minutes, I wanted to talk about fear, because at one point, fear seemed to encompass you, the very existence of you. You write how you were afraid of everything, that fear directed your life, and it directed your emotions and your frustrations and your resentment and just all of it, the anger and the rage. Afraid of fear was overcoming you, which could lead to physiological responses like, you know, stuttering and baying and hiccups and all kinds of, and that would be interpreted as weakness, not bravado. How did you get over that?
You know, that was, it was especially prevalent in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was this, you had to operate with the notion that things around you could hurt you and they hurt you terminally, they're infinite, you know, and they were constant. And I was in Al-Anbar province about a year after the Battle of Fallujah. And it was a very violent place then. It was at the very end, right before the Great Awakening occurs in Sunni Iraq, and it calms down to a degree. And so it was a very violent place. And so you felt this constant undercurrent of fear constantly. You would drive down the road and wonder if you're going to roll, if the guy mm-hmm. driving the Humvee was going to roll mm-hmm. a pothole that was going to, you know, blow a third of the Humvee into the sky with you in it, you know, like, or whether walking down the street was going to elicit a sniper shot, or going into a house was going to be, you're going to find it mined, or there was a myriad of things that could hurt you. The odds were in your favor. And that was the thing about it. The odds were in your favor that you were going to come home just fine, but it didn't. It was still a gamble. There were still odds being played. There were mm-hmm. still dice being rolled every time you stepped foot outside the gates. And that was a really, really prevalent and very, very visceral thing to feel. And it's a very sickening feeling. It's strange to describe because it's very, very real and very, very ugly, that fear. It's animalistic. But there was also fears of that showing itself.
Mm-hmm.
I was terrified of like that being something somebody saw in me, because you know I didn't want to be the weak guy in the room. You know?
Right. Oh no, you couldn't do that.
Know, and you needed to stand up to it, you know, and you needed to be able to have the emotional intelligence to sort of deal and navigate around it. And I never ran into, well, toward the end of my time in the military, I never ran into what I would consider to be terribly toxic versions of masculinity. Mm-hmm. It does exist in the military, and I wouldn't suggest anything else. But I was in a place, both I think by virtue of my position and my job, that I didn't encounter much of it. But even then, it was very important that I appeared to be competent at what I was doing, mm-hmm. right? Especially within an infantry unit. It was like, I need you to know that I'm good at doing this, and I'm terrified if you think that I'm a failure at this.
Well,
I'm going to hurt you.
We have run out of time. This has been fantastic. I want to say thank you for your interview, but it is time out for this edition of 411 Teen, and a special thanks again to Jared Alexander, author of Volunteers Growing Up in the Forever War. Much appreciation to my listening audience for your continued support of 411 Teen and the privilege of your time and ear. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to past episodes at WFSU.org.